You're listening to episode 25 of Fear the Boots interview series. In this interview, we talk with James Lauder. Running time for this episode is 58 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
But this is Johan.
This is Wayne.
My name is Pat.
And joining us today is guest James Lauder.
Hey there.
Jim, we're going to start this the same way we do all of our interviews. For anyone at home who's not familiar with your name, who doesn't know who you are, I'd love to have you give a quick resume of what you've done, what you're doing right now. And actually, you know, at times I feel a little silly doing these, but I've been talking to a couple people, other gamers recently. And until I started doing this podcast, I really didn't know any names myself. I knew the games I liked. I knew the products I liked. I maybe even knew the companies I liked. But I had no idea who had actually written what until we started doing these interviews and we started doing this show. Am I the only one here?
No.
I don't know until the person on the mic tells me.
That's actually a really common problem.
Yeah.
Really common problem. And it actually, there are a lot of people in the industry, they'll come for interviews in game companies and they won't realize that the people they're interviewing with are people who have designed games they liked. And it is not uncommon for game companies to set up traps for people who are interviewing, asking, you know, kind of leading questions about games that the person interviewing, you know, the candidate had designed, waiting to see if they actually recognize that the person they're speaking to is the person who designed the game under discussion.
Okay, so with that said, Jim, you want to clear up the air here with anyone at home who's not heard your name. What's some of the stuff you've worked on?
Well, I've actually been in publishing and part of the hobby games industry for, something like 25 years. Got my start in the industry at TSR, working in the book division there on Forgotten Realms and Ravenloft and Dark Sun, first time around when those were published. I did some game design work on D&D and some of the other lines like that. And for the last 20 years, I've been a freelancer doing editing and writing fiction and putting together books and game design and whatever else people want to hire me for.
Yeah, I know you've also done some comic book work, too.
I have. I've been recently editing the Hackslash series for Image and been working with Tim Seeley on that. But I've also, you know, scripted a few comics here and there. I'm fortunate that way. I've had the chance to work on all kinds of different media, really whatever I've been interested in as a fan, I've had a chance to work on, as a professional.
Before we get into the interview proper, Johan has something he wants to ask you about.
Yes, this refers back to some work that you did back for TSR in the second edition days, I believe.
Oh, dear.
Oh, yeah. This is wonderful. It's actually one of my favorite products that was put out during that time period. Spelljammer. Talk.
Oh, yes.
Come on. Who's responsible for the hamsters? Tell us it was you.
Oh, it was not me, I'm afraid. I actually did work on Spelljammer. I did some stuff for one of the Monstrous Compendiums, and I was actually a developer on the original box set.
Which actually leads me to a tangential question that occurred to me when I was looking this up. What does that mean? I mean, there were writers, and there were like three or four names listed simply as developer that I have no idea what that means, because there were separate listings for the people who wrote the words and the people who designed the rules, and then a developer. So I was just very curious as to what that job entailed.
Well, for that one in particular, I wasn't officially working on the Spelljammer box set. When Jeff Grubb was doing the design, we ended up in a lot of discussions about the content, and I provided input and gave him some comments on some of the things that he was working on. And Jeff is a very gracious guy and a very generous guy, and based on the discussions and my input from those, you know, I got a development credit.
So developer as a title in the credits page actually means guy in the next cube?
Guy in the other department. I was working in books at the time. And actually, originally, I was slated to be the fiction editor for the original Spelljammer novels when they were first putting those together. I came up with the concept for the Spelljammer novels, but ended up not doing those. I think it was because I started working on Dark Sun. But I was kind of involved with it that way, too. One of the things that I did when I was working in the book division, I was the book editor who had the most game experience, because I'd been a gamer since, you know, high school. Mm-hmm. And I played D&D. And so I spoke both languages. I could do game design stuff. I could do the fiction stuff. I had a degree in English and had done short stories and everything else before that. So when they had book projects that actually had a lot of crossover with the game material, I was the one who got those assignments.
So how much input did you have in the book projects early on? I mean, are you given basically an outline that says this is what the book is supposed to be about? Or do you pitch that? Here's my idea for a story in this world.
Wayne, that's a great question. I would love to hear the answer. But I first have to observe that we've been interviewing more and more people that used to work at TSR. And this is like the Nuremberg trials. No matter how many people we talk to,
no one invented the space hamsters.
Yeah, nobody was responsible for Spelljammer. We are going to figure this out eventually.
I like Spelljammer.
I like Spelljammer too. I just don't like the space hamsters. But yes, the two things that no one will ever, ever take credit for or point fingers for is the space hamsters and Red Steel.
Yes.
Red Steel was after my time. That one I can genuinely say I had nothing to do with it.
And with the space hamsters, you were just following orders. All right. So, all right, go ahead. I'm sorry. Wayne did have a good question.
So it depends upon the project. One of the first editing projects that I had at TSR was working on the Avatar books for the Forgotten Realms. And those were basically a house-driven project. The books were supposed to explain the transition from first edition to second edition D&D within the Forgotten Realms. And so there were some general marching orders that were coming down from on high. And as the book editor, it was my job to work with the authors to make sure that everything kind of lined up with that, and then coordinate whatever changes were going on in the books with the people that were doing the game design for second edition, and keeping everything kind of running along the same tracks. Fiction and game design have two very, very different aesthetics. A good story is not necessarily a good game. A good game is not necessarily a good piece of fiction. So it's a matter of translating things back and forth between the two media.
Could you expound on that a little bit? I agree with you, but I would just love to hear how you explain that.
Well, a good game provides a platform for the people you gather around your table to tell a group story, to make your own story around that material, around that platform. A good piece of fiction has narrative integrity. It holds together and it tells a specific story with theme and character and all of that stuff fully developed. And it's inviting you to interact with the story, but it's not doing that in the same way that you interact with a game.
In the case of Forgotten Realms in particular, though, we'll just use that as our example here. It seems like there's something of an inescapable overlap because of the fact that the fiction tells the world story. As an example, I prefer the Forgotten Realms prior to the Time of Trouble. I liked it back in like the old gold box sort of days, whereas the current products obviously all take place after the Time of Troubles. And the Time of Troubles, you know, came from stories that were told in the novels and characters that were brought up in the novels. And so there's this sort of inevitable impact between the two. You know, you can't pick up the source book for the Forgotten Realms. And sure, you can absolutely tell your own story, and I do so with absolutely no problem. But you can't escape the fact that you still have the Harpers, and you have Elminster, and you have all these things that came from that macro story. They're kind of, and yeah, I know the ultimate line here is it's your game, keep and eject whatever you want, it's your world, do whatever you want with it. I mean, it's not like someone's going to show up at your house and break your kneecaps.
No, but, not right now. Wait until fifth edition.
but I'm curious, how do you handle that? Or is there a way you think it ought to be handled to keep the novels cogent and meaningful without actually having them drive so much of the game world that a part of it really doesn't feel like it belongs to the people playing at home anymore?
Sure. And that's a great question. And it's one that TSR and Wizards of the Coast as companies have struggled with since they came up with the idea of tying the campaign settings to the novels. And Dragonlance is actually a really good example of that. If you played the original Dragonlance modules, they followed along to the plots of the original books very, very closely. And you were essentially playing those characters from the novels. And that's where it isn't necessarily a successful gaming product simply because you're being shown the rails you have to follow along. And in a larger sense, when you talk about the Time of Troubles and Avatar and different things that have happened in the novels that impact the game world for the Forgotten Realms, that's, you know, it's showing you rails that you sort of have to follow. The best balance that you can possibly strike, in my opinion, is kind of running two parallel narratives. And in a way, we did this with the Empires series, where the modules that were running parallel to the Empires novels really were just a parallel story that could go any way. I mean, it didn't have a predestined conclusion that was dictated by the novels as fiercely as it was, say, with the Dragonlance modules. And that allows players then to create their own parallel world. But it's going to be a problem that the players and the companies continue to struggle with. And what's ended up happening in the long run is there are points at which people say, this novel line is officially canon, and then suddenly it's not, because somebody somewhere in the game division decides, well, we're going to go in a different direction. So now this is no longer true. Moon Elves work a different way than they did in Elaine Cunningham's original novels. And therefore, those novels then become suspect. It's tricky, because if people are really big fans of those novels, they're going to be unhappy with the world going in that direction.
Jim, one of the things that you have a lot of experience with that I'd love to hear you talk about is writing shared world fiction. Because obviously in these worlds that you're playing in, you are not the only person playing in them. And here I'm not even talking about the folks at home. I'm talking even within the company. And I wonder what it's been like. What are the challenges? What are the workarounds? What are the lessons you've taken away from doing fiction in shared worlds?
The best thing about them is something that you've just touched on, and that is the fact that you're actually working with a team. When I first started working in the Forgotten Realms as an editor and then a writer, there's really nothing quite like being able to go to Gen Con and getting up on a panel with Bob Salvatore and Ed Greenwood and Doug Niles and Jeff Grubb, Elaine Cunningham and Zeb Cook, the other people that I was working with, and knowing that we're all working together and creating this world, that we're sharing things, that we're actually contacting each other and working together to create this fictional setting. And that sort of support, because writing in and of itself is an isolating, independent process. Doing a project where you're actually part of a team like that has a lot of emotional, creative support benefits. That part of it is brilliant. And the fans know the material and they're being drawn in by other writers who are working in it. So they're going to give your work more of a chance if you're just breaking in. All great stuff. The bad part is you're also working with a lot of creative constraints, and it's very easy for that collaborative shared atmosphere to become one where essentially the creators are being stepped on. You work in a shared world for a while and you move on to another project, or you're suddenly not part of the in crowd anymore, and the publisher blows up the stuff you created. Characters that you spent 4 years writing are now suddenly killed off in 3 pages because somebody thought it was a good idea. And that can be brutal, because if you're doing the job right as a writer, you're investing your own creativity into that material. And that's part of the reason you see such burnout with shared worlds. People who work in shared worlds for a while will look back at them and kind of, you know, grimace a little bit at what has happened to the things that they've done. And you see that now, I mean, even in comics and things like that, where people looking back at the New 52 with DC and the other things that are happening there, characters that they created are suddenly being completely reimagined in ways that they never intended. When you sign the contract, you know that's a possibility, but in some ways you always think that it's not going to happen to your stuff.
That's always been one of my favorite questions when doing any kind of an interview with somebody that's written comic books, is, you know, to go into what happens to some of those characters. I can't imagine doing that, creating a character, getting behind the character, putting it out there, and then coming back and seeing that someone else has done what you would consider destroying your character.
Well, and it can happen literally, too. One of the first things that came out, and I can use a personal example here, one of the first things that came out with 4th edition Forgotten Realms, when they jumped the timeline ahead 100 years and they changed the maps and all of this other stuff, was some material about Chult. And the city that I had developed in this whole area that I had built up by myself, it had been a blank spot on the map, was literally a smoking hole in the ground. And I sort of looked at it and thought, oh, there went a year of my life. It's gone.
So, all right, Dish, what did you do to who to piss them off?
See, that's a whole nother interview.
I've got my guesses here. There was a story that you told us at Comic-Con when we first interviewed you before my audio device ate that interview. And we're going to talk about Comic-Con here in a little bit, because I do have some things I want to talk about related to that. But there was a story you told us there about somebody's robots.
Oh, that, yeah, no, that was something we did for fun. That was not anybody mad at me. If there's a reason why any of my stuff would get paved over at TSR, and I've had Wizards of the Coast, and I've had my disagreements with both companies over the years, and basically it's about the treatment of creators. And that's something that I learned working in-house at TSR.
All right, we'll go and fess up to the robots first, and we'll talk
the robot story was one of the things that used to happen. I mean, TSR was a great place to work when first started there in the late 80s. The story that Dan's mentioning here is one of the years when the management went to Toy Fair. We took all of Zeb Cook's robots out of his cube and lined them up down the hallways because he had a zillion robots and Godzillas and stuff in his cube. We used to do a lot of that sort of stuff when management went away. We'd play par three golf through the cubes upstairs people would go to conventions and they'd come back, and Jeff Grubb one time came back and his entire cube was filled with wadded up paper and just taped off and things like that. But no, any source of disagreement that I would have with TSR back in the day and even with Wizards now is basically over that sort of creative control of material and the way that they do or don't allow people creative freedom in the stuff they're working on.
So let's talk about creative rights. How did it work? How does it work? And in your mind, how ought it work?
Well, shared worlds are always tricky because depending on the project you're working on, the writer is bringing either very little in terms of character creation or world creation. You may be, say you're working on a Star Trek novel or a Star Wars novel and you're dealing with core characters that were already developed. You're being asked to essentially tell a story with things that you may not have a lot of creative investment in. When you start getting into shared world fiction as it's related to games, that's actually relatively rare. Game-related shared world fiction is usually set up so that the authors are usually creating most of the characters, maybe creating the part of the world that they're dealing with as well. And if they are dealing with a book where they're dealing with an existing character, for example, when I did Knight of the Black Rose, Lord Soth existed. And when I did that, most of the supporting characters in that book were all things that I created by myself. Those were characters that I originated, the setting and different aspects of how that was all developed were things that I added to that material. And so it's always a balancing act. For a publisher, what you're really hoping is you're going to get writers who will come in and be creatively and emotionally invested in what they're writing for you, that they will give you something that they consider special, that their talent will add to the development of your world. For example, like R.A. Salvatore, you're going to get a character like Drist, who was added on to the Forgotten Realms. Bob created that character pretty much outside of the realms on his own, and Drist was grafted onto the realms. Think about how much that has added to that setting and how much that has added to the value of that setting. That's what you're hoping for. The downside of that for a creative is if you take a character like Drist and you add it on there and the company starts doing Drist underoos and lunchboxes, you may not get control of it. You may not get a piece of it.
I have it.
And then the other aspect of that is you at any time can be replaced on that character. And Drist is a good example there. There was a point at which, and some people may not know this, there was a point at which at the end of the TSR reign, Bob was on the outs with the book department. And Bob was almost replaced as the writer of Drist. There was a novel written by Mark Anthony, Shores of Dusk, that was completed. And it was ready to go to the printer. They had gone through, and the person that was running the book division had actually gone through and asked a whole bunch of different people if they would take on Drist. If they, you know, Salvatore's not going to do it anymore. We want somebody else to do it. Are you interested? I was one of the people they asked. A lot of people turned them down, including me. But, you know, Mark Anthony came on and he wrote the book and it was ready to go. Wizards of the Coast bought the company and the book went away because they wanted Bob to come back because they recognized the value of having R.A. Salvatore continue to write the Drist material.
So just to clarify, there is in fact a completely unpublished and unread Drist novel floating around out there?
There is.
You have just made a million geeks cry.
Shores of Dusk. But it is not an R.A. Salvatore Drist novel. It is not one that Bob wrote. It is one someone else wrote.
I can hear the weeping from here.
So how do you think it ought to be handled? Because if I'm sitting in the shoes of TSR, WotC, or FOSS, or whatever company out there, you know, I don't know if I'm going to be too keen on the idea that there's a significant moving part of a broader intellectual property I own but that part is not under my control. You know, let's say for tomorrow, I went out and I published some RPG setting of my own and it becomes the next big thing ever in the world. And somebody comes along and writes a great novel. It centers around a handful of characters. I want them to be invested in it. You know, obviously, if I'm in the author's shoes, I want to own that. I don't want somebody else playing in my playground and, quite frankly, screwing it up. But the company's not going to be too fond of the idea that they own Star Trek, but somebody else owns James T. Kirk. What do you think that ought to look like?
Well, it depends on the project. It depends on what the company is trying to do with the fiction. I've done some projects that are pretty interesting middle ground. I did two anthologies of superhero fiction for Silver Age Sentinels. And the stories in those two books are creator copyrighted. Any characters that the authors created are copyright to the authors. Any characters that were existing in the SAS universe, the Silver Age Sentinels universe, before they sat down and started writing, anybody that they reference from the core source books, those still belong to the company. Kind of the potluck dinner idea, where basically we're inviting the authors to bring a dish, and when they're done with the dinner, they get to take their own dish home, but they don't get to take the silverware. They don't get to take the tablecloth.
I guess the downside of that from the company standpoint, though, let's say you do that. You come in, you introduce a character that suddenly becomes a fan favorite character that they would like to then broaden within their setting, they could potentially be out of luck. They can't include it in the next novel that someone else is writing, in the next game system. It's something that they produced, fans love it, but now because of that type of licensing, they don't have access to it.
Well, sure, but the easiest way to do that is to say, look, you know, this is a successful character. You know it's successful. We know it's successful. We're willing to pay you X to do this, and we want to continue it. And if it's really successful, and it really is going to reap rewards for the company can afford to pay somebody to do that. You know, is it tricky? Absolutely. Are you far more likely to get people to work on your shared world book than you might get otherwise? Sure, you will. And I mean, we saw this when I did the zombie anthologies for Eden Studios, the Books of Flesh trilogy. Normally, and this is a discussion I've been having with different publishers in the hobby industry for 20 years now since I left TSR. Normally, people would look at those anthologies and say, well, it's published. It's got the All Flesh Must Be Eaten brand on it because it's being published kind of in parallel to the role-playing game. None of the stories are directly derived from the role-playing game, because if you're familiar with All Flesh Must Be Eaten, it's a bunch of different dead worlds. Every one of them is different, and it doesn't have a central set of characters or a central plot or a central world. And initially, when I talked to Eden about it, they said, well, you know, this will be like other game-related fiction. It'll be all rights. And I told them that we would be far more likely to get writers who wouldn't touch a game-related project or wouldn't touch a shared world project if we do this as creator-owned. And there really was no reason for them to want to own this, because nobody was using James T. Kirk that already existed, because there wasn't one. And if somebody hit upon a dead world, if somebody hit upon a setting that was really great, then it would be very easy to license that and do a game supplement for it. And look, the authors are reasonable people 95-98% of the time. They're going to be happy to see that kind of expansion for their world, and you'll be able to work out something really reasonably. And what ended up happening was we got a ton of submissions for those books, and a lot of people got involved in them who wouldn't normally, you know, it played out kind of exactly as I suggested. And the quality of those books is really high. I think a third of the books overall ended up being honorable mentions in Year's Best Fantasy and Horror, which anything published even in conjunction with a game very rarely gets mentioned in those kind of things. It was shortlisted for the International Horror Guild Award, and that was directly because the better contract was offered, so we got better writers.
Let me ask you a really blunt question. After your first time getting burned with non-creator-owned products, did you ever find yourself holding back some of your best work because you knew you wouldn't have it at the end of the day?
What I ended up doing was actually turning the projects down. I've been offered an awful lot of books that were shared world projects. And what I learned after I left TSR was that unless there were certain conditions to the creative development of these projects, I didn't want to do it because I didn't want to do a book where I wouldn't offer my best stuff.
Right.
If you're a writer and you look at the idea of somebody coming along later and doing something to your character, don't ever do a shared world book. If you look at that with dread, don't do it, because it will inevitably happen. That's part of the ground rules. Now, even with the James T. Kirk thing, even with the borrowed aspects of the Shared World stuff, there are things that publishers can do that make the deal fairer for the creator. You can put a clause in your contract that costs you absolutely nothing, where if you do a sequel to a book, the author that wrote the book gets first dibs. Simple. It just means then that if you write a book and it's successful and the company decides they're going to do a sequel, you're going to get first shot at it. And it doesn't have to be for better terms. It can be for exactly the same money you wrote the book for the first time. But a lot of publishers won't do that sort of stuff. Even more importantly, and this is the aspect where it takes a little thought in how you set up the world. One of the things I did in the course of working for TSR, when I started, the first editing, real hard editing projects I did where I was the lead editor were things like Avatar, which were company-driven plots. Shortly after that, I started pitching things like the Harper series. And I was the one who originated that at TSR in the book division for the Forgotten Realms, because those books were standalone. The authors were generally the ones who created the characters, and they took place in parts of the world that hadn't been developed. And the individual plots did not have a world-shaking impact. They were character-focused, much more tightly controlled stories. What it allowed was maximum creator input. The writers got to tell stories that they wanted to tell within the larger sandbox, and there was no reason then for somebody to come along immediately and rewrite that character and change that part of the world. And we got some great standalone books, and it developed the world, and kind of everybody won. They operated much more like a creator-owned book project. And some shared world publishers get that, and some don't. I just did two novels for White Wolf. I edited them. And they specifically brought me on for these two books because they wanted me to direct these books to maximize creator input on them. One of them is out already. They've ended up serializing them, and the first one is out, Strangeness in the Proportion. That's just a brilliant novel by itself. It's got a connection to the World of Darkness. It develops the World of Darkness. It is a World of Darkness novel, but it's a brilliant piece of writing. And it could stand up as a book, and the process under which it was put together was essentially identical to somebody writing a creator-owned book.
I've got several things that I want to talk about on the aspect of editing this work. And we're also going to tie that into your most recent project, at least that I'm aware of, which is Beyond the Wall. But before we get to that, there's something here that you posed for this interview in our email conversation that I just can't pass up, which is, you said, is game-related fiction more likely to be bad than non-game-related fiction?
Yes, next topic.
My basic stance is yes, but not because it's related to a game, but because of the contracts and the creative conditions under which it's published. Okay, now, I'll agree with Johan. My basic stance here is yes, but I would love to hear your angle on this. Why do you tie it back to the environment and to the creative rights?
Before we get to that, I want to hear why you think automatically that it is.
For two reasons. One, because of the fact that I think a lot of times the authors are bigger fans than they are writers. They tend to love the material more than they actually love the craft of writing. And secondly, I think the authors seem to fall into one of two categories. Those that do not know a damn thing about the games, or those that know the games and know them well, and what they're generally doing is transcribing their most recent game sessions.
I say, I'll add one other thing to this, that a lot of times you have what seems like a solid voice come through in the original, with the original game or original whatever you're working with, and the tone doesn't seem the same in the book. So it comes off more like fan fiction, yeah. Like something that doesn't quite fit.
Right.
Because the tone, the pacing, the voice,
there was
all different.
One book in particular I can think of that illustrates almost every angle of this was a Shadowrun short story anthology, and I don't recall its name. I can remember that it had Stackpole, some stuff in it with the Halloweeners who had like the pump, had like a jack-o'-lantern face paint, and there was one of the stories in there, so it wasn't a Stackpole story.
Maybe
it was Into the Shadows, I don't remember, but there was one of the other stories in there was about a were-tigress, and I really felt that one book, you saw every angle of that. You saw somebody wanking to their favorite character. You saw somebody who didn't know anything about the setting and really didn't get the setting. You saw somebody where pretty much you could guess that you were just reading a transcript of their last gaming session. Yeah.
And that's what anthologies are for, variety.
Yeah. Yeah. Every shade of bad that you can imagine.
To clarify my opinion on your question, the reason I immediately answered no is that I have read game-related fiction. So therefore, I know that the answer is no, it is not as good, at least for the most part. And I've got my own theories as to why that is that don't necessarily line up as much.
Well, what is your theory?
What is it? Yeah.
Well, I get the distinct impression that a lot of them are written by people who would much rather be writing something else. I just think they don't care. This is, I need a paycheck, my mortgage is due, let me slap out 300 pages and send it off to the printers.
You framed this initially by asking me, well, you know, why do I tie this back to the conditions under which it's created? Mm-hmm. Every single one of the shortcomings that you've all identified, and all of them are accurate to one degree or another, all of them point back to the conditions under which the stuff is created. Why do you end up with writers who are hired guns, who don't really know anything about the world and are doing this to make a paycheck? Because the contract is kind of crummy. They're not going to own the rights to the character when they're done with it. So why should you invest everything in it if the likelihood that this is going to actually pay you back in the long run is limited by the contract you're signing and the creative conditions, where you are likely to come up with a really brilliant, this is actually part of the reason why I left TSR. I was contracted to write a Ravenloft trilogy. It was going to be the first Ravenloft trilogy. I created the domain. I created all of the characters. This was the least shared of the shared world sort of idea. Literally, there were dozens of people at one point or another giving me input on this material, and you would get contradictory comments saying it should be darker, it should be lighter, the main character should be more cynical, the main character should be less cynical. Where's the return then in actually putting yourself out there and putting something really creative on the table when that's the creative review conditions you're going to get?
Did that's you file your TPS reports?
Exactly right. You're missing the cover for your TPS report. And oh, by the way, here's the new cover for the TPS reports. Oh, we don't use covers anymore. That's the sort of thing that can happen, you know, because you've got different people in different departments reviewing things. People are reviewing them for different criteria. A game editor is going to look at something and say, you missed listing every component in that fireball spell. And if you go in and you list every component in that fireball spell, you're going to hear the dice rolling in the background, and it's going to sound like you're writing a game session. The other part of it is, if the publisher comes in and creates a condition under which the only people who understand the world are the people who are designing the world, and the game designers are then handed the responsibility of writing the fiction attached to it, they may be good game designers, doesn't mean they're good fiction writers.
Well, I think you hit on another thing too. You said, who would want to write in that environment? The fanboys who are going to make it come out like fanboys.
That's
fiction.
What I was going to say.
Exactly, exactly right. So you see, I mean, if you look at this and you say, you know, the contract has got problems and the creative environment is such that, you know, you're not necessarily going to be getting real fiction review. You're going to be getting game review to your fiction project. It's maximizing the chances then for this to come out badly. And it's also driving away the people who want to invest themselves creatively in it. Now, all of that said, there are people, and there are people at Wizards of the Coast who are writing great books now. There are people that work in all the shared worlds that can actually write and actually care about what they're doing. But the system is set up to eventually drive them out.
And such, all you're left with is that is either the mercenaries or the fanboys.
Or you come in and you get new people who come in and they get lightning in a bottle like they did with Bob Salvatore. You know, Bob came in and submitted something blind to the Forgotten Realms. Here, I want to write a sequel to Doug Niles' book. No, we won't have you write a sequel to Doug Niles' book, but you know what? This other stuff you're doing and this Drist guy, they really work. So how about you write a novel with that? You know, and that was partly because Mary Kirchhoff, who was the editor of the book division at TSR at the time, who also understood kind of that bridge between games and fiction because she could do both, recognized what it was in what Salvatore was submitting that had value, that could make good fiction.
I have a question about that because you sort of hit what I was thinking about on the head there. Is it a rarity to find sort of a good symbiosis between, say, the management and the creative side? Do you ever really find that, or is that just sort of the holy grail that you're always chasing? I think it's a problem in every kind of a business where you've got your management who they know how to run a business, but they have no freaking clue about what the business is that they're running. And that's what the creative people do.
Sure. And the point at which I left TSR was a point at which people were being put in charge of management who actually didn't understand the games at all. They were coming from manufacturing backgrounds and basically everything was widgets. And you start getting decisions based on that. You also get this really weird input of marketing and legal defining what can and can't be done. And basically, the answer you're almost always going to get from a legal department is no. Can we do this? No. Why? Because it'll set a bad precedent. And so contracts then steadily get worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. The contracts that I signed for TSR back in the late 80s and early 90s are far superior to the ones that Wizards of the Coast are offering people now. There are clauses in the contracts now that have things to do with control of PR and all of this other stuff that TSR never would have thought of back in the late 80s. And it impacts who you get working for you and who you can keep long-term writing for you. It's a tricky balance. And, it, you know, can you find it? Yes. The two books I just edited for White Wolf, you know, Rich Thomas and Eddie Webb over at White Wolf, they hired me specifically to do what we've been discussing. They hired me specifically to do that. They knew that was my philosophy going in. They wanted me to do that. You know, Stuart Wick originally was the one who brought me onto that project. He had published a couple of my short stories after I left TSR. And that was one of the things that was, you know, my experience with White Wolf's fiction, the short stories that I wrote for them, was all very positive. They gave very little interference. They wanted it to be good fiction. The people that were working there knew fiction. They hired people who understood fiction, and it was a really good process. It can happen, but it actually takes a lot of effort to make it happen.
I want to talk about your philosophy as an editor here, but let's tie this in to the project you just released, the book you sent me a preview copy right before Comic-Con, and then I saw actual copies of it at Comic-Con. I was wondering if you just tell our audience a little bit about that book, what it is, and what's in it.
Sure. It's the most recent project I've worked on is a book called Beyond the Wall, and it's a collection of essays for Ben Bella's Smart Pop line about the George Martin Ice and Fire novels. And it collects, you know, more than a dozen essays from authors and game designers and literary critics covering different aspects of the Ice and Fire novels, and, you know, gives you critical lenses for ways to view the material, and covers things like adapting the novels into comic books or collecting Martin editions now that books are starting to become electronic entities and things like that.
One of the things that I found fascinating about it, you describe it as the literary aspects of the book, which is absolutely correct, but I think it would almost be, I don't say more correct, but maybe a bit more informative to describe it as the social aspects of the books. Because in reading through some of the chapters, it covers things like the role of sexuality or even sexual power, things like rape and whatnot in the story. It talks about the lack of a moral center or a moral consistency for the land. It talks about the role of the outsider, the role of the unwanted, the freak and the weirdo. It deals with a lot of things that I would say, yes, they're absolutely literary themes, but I think they step beyond that to become much more personal and really become social themes.
Well, the great part about the Smart Pop line in general, and I've published a couple of essays with them for other books. I did an essay on a book of, about the original King Kong, and did another one on the X-Men. They're middle ground material. They're not fan essays. They're not things saying, oh, this stuff is great because we love it. You know, we love it because we love it. And here's just more people saying we love it because we love it. And it's not strictly dry academic stuff with four pages of endnotes for a three-page essay and things like that. They've got intellectual heft to them. But basically, they're talking to people about why the authors who are participating in the book care about the material, what they find attractive. And some of it is exactly what you're saying. It's that idea of community. It's that idea of discussion. And ideally, if you read the book from front to back, you're going to get a sense of a conversation between the authors, because there are some of the essays that disagree on things like the moral center, whether there is a moral center in the universe in these novels.
One of the things that we talked about at Comic-Con, as you were describing this, is I said it would be very hard for me as an editor to read through this and not want to get my own two cents in. I have too much of a writer's impulse, a creator's impulse, that I'd want to say something. And you described to me a philosophy that you take as an editor, which seems to be based on sympathies that you developed as a writer that I loved.
And you're absolutely right. So much of what I've done in my career and since, you know, talking about my own experiences with TSR, I learned basically all of the good things about publishing and shared worlds working at TSR, and I learned all of the bad things. And I learned, you know, good example, bad example, and it was all within the same, you know, 6-year span. What I try to do as an editor is to set aside my own impulses as a writer, because I do consider myself a writer first, but I try to set that aside. And my job as an editor is to basically help the author fine-tune his or her vision, to clarify what they're trying to achieve, and to be sort of an ideal reader and a critic to go through and challenge what they're doing and ask them if what I'm seeing is the best that they can do or is reaching the conclusions that they want to reach.
That's what I loved, is that description that you gave both here and at Comic-Con. Your goal as an editor is not to change what they're doing, but to help them accomplish their own goals in the best way possible. And that is something that it seems like, even in my brief interactions with publishing, a lot of editors don't get. They see it as their role to basically like, well, I'm not going to write it myself, but I'm going to basically strong arm the writer into doing what I want, as opposed to going back to the writer and saying, what is it you're trying to accomplish here? And how do we accomplish that correctly?
Right. It's really kind of a simple rule for me is, I treat other people's work the way I would want my work treated. And if I find, as a writer, if I look at something and I'm marking something up, and I am a tough editor. You can talk to Bob Salvatore, Elaine Cunningham, or some of the people, you know, in Beyond the Wall, and ask, did I put them through their paces in working on these things? And I do. I am the first one to admit you'll get an essay back from me or a story back from me with a lot of comments, and they'll be blunt. But I'm always clear that my name is not the one going on this essay. My name's not the one going on the novel. And I'll provide suggestions and I'll provide input, but at the end of the day, it's not my work.
The way I want to close this one out, well, actually, the way we usually close these out, I typically ask the person we're interviewing if they've got anything coming up that they'd like to draw people's attention to. But Jim, it sounds like right now the big thing is Beyond the Wall. If I recall correctly, you told me at Comic-Con that you've got some other things, but they're still at the NDA phase, so there's really nothing to fill in here anyway. Is that still correct?
Yeah, that's pretty much true. I'd mention Hack Slash. I'm doing a script for one of the upcoming issues of Hack Slash, and I'm continuing to edit that and working on a bunch of smaller things. But yeah, there's a couple of bigger projects that I talked about at San Diego and that I will be talking about with some of the publishers at Gen Con who will be attending both,
right?
That are kind of, like you said, in that NDA stage.
And before we get then to our final topic here, which is I want to talk about Gen Con and Comic-Con themselves. Is there a website or a place that people can go to keep up with what you're doing, to see what you've got out there? Is there kind of a ground zero for all things Jim Louder?
My website is jameslouder.com, and that's a good place to kind of see what I have worked on and what I kind of got going on at the moment. But I'm also on Facebook, and if people look for James Louder on Facebook, they'll probably find me.
Okay, and I will be sure to link to Jim's website in the show notes, just in case you're unclear how to spell James or Louder, I guess you could put a U instead of a W in there. But either way, that will be in the show notes. So if anyone's looking for that during their commute to work or whatnot, you can find it on the website once you get there. But let's close this one out by talking about Comic-Con versus Gen Con, because by the time this show drops, we will be really close to Gen Con. In fact, Gen Con will either have already started or be about to start, one of the two. I can't remember which without looking at my calendar. But this was the first year that any of us associated with this podcast went to Comic-Con. And if I'm not mistaken, Gen Con right now, in terms of attendance, is running somewhere just underneath around, 40,000 attendees, I think.
Yeah. Somewhere in that ballpark.
Yeah. And they are right now in a growth trend, which is absolutely a wonderful thing, both for that convention and for our hobby as a whole. But when I walked into Comic-Con, I had trouble getting the numbers on the place. I was quoted numbers all over the place. The highest number that I heard was that between ticketed people attending the con and unticketed people that simply would show up and hang out in,
Gas Lamp Quarter, which is right at the convention center.
Yeah, which is the neighborhood right around the convention center. Basically just be there for the sake of being immersed in the culture, that they estimate the total attendance to the convention and surrounding events is somewhere in the neighborhood of 500,000 people. And the lowest number I was quoted by anyone I asked was ticketed attendance somewhere around 120,000. So obviously that's a bit of a spread. I don't know what's correct. I've not researched it. I'm sure a quick hit of Google could fix that for me. But the point is that any way you crack it, Comic-Con is a hell of a lot bigger than Gen Con.
Right.
It's bigger in terms of attendance. It's bigger in terms of the money spent. It's bigger in terms of the spectacle. I mean, the exhibitors hall alone, I was told, if you were to unwind it, would be somewhere between 6 and 7 miles in length. And so, I mean, it is an absolutely enormous thing.
I mean, to get a good sense of it, you know, Hall H, which is where they have the big spectacle Twilight panel and things like that, is something like a 6,500 seat auditorium.
And it's a dangerous place, too.
They have people lined up for days waiting to get in, you know, 6,000 people waiting to get into this hall.
You know, that was the biggest thing that surprised me about Comic-Con is the fact that you just mentioned there is that there were all these panels. And this is something I've actually been telling sort of the people, you know, that I work with and friends and family. They ask me about Comic-Con. It's like, well, what's it about? And tell me about this, that, and the other. Like, what do you do? I said, well, there are 20 panels going on at any given time. So you have to pick and choose what you might want to go to. But what astounds me is that people that bought tickets to go to Comic-Con then stood in line for 3 days to go to an event, well, specifically like the Firefly event.
To see the Serenity Cast.
Serenity Cast. So that means that they stood in line the entire time. So it's like they paid for a ticket to stand in a line to maybe get in to see the Firefly people.
See one event. Well, here's the thing, though, that really got me thinking. If I look at Comic-Con, Jim, we were talking at Comic-Con about comic book numbers. And I think the statistics you quoted me, and once again, correct me here if I'm getting any of this wrong, was that back in the golden age of comics, and by golden age here, I don't mean literally the golden age of comic book history. I mean, golden age is when comic books were really popular, okay, so 50s and 60s or whatever, that a print run of 500,000 was considered a failure. And now the best titles are moving about 120,000 copies. So comic books themselves as an industry are really not in great shape, much like the role-playing industry, okay? It's kind of all over the place. The giants, if you look at the comic books alone, are really not doing any better than the handful of giants left in the role-playing industry. And you have a lot of decentralization and so on and so forth. But it strikes me that the difference between Comic-Con and Gen Con is with comic books, that industry has gotten big because of the sudden tie-in, the mining of its intellectual properties for television and movies. I mean, there are so many major TV shows and movies that are coming out all the time now that are based either wholly or partially on a comic book series. Obviously, Thor, Spider-Man, Dark Knight Rises, Walking Dead. I mean, the list just goes on and on and on like that.
And Comic-Con really hasn't been a comic book convention in years. It's a overall geek convention, actually, right. Comic book theme.
It's a pop culture convention. That's the terminology that I learned there because I was wondering that before I went. It's like, what all is there? And that perfectly describes it. It's pop culture.
Did I see comic book related stuff? Absolutely, all over the place. Did I see comic books themselves for sale? Yes, but not in that many places. The bulk of the exhibition booths I passed were not selling long boxes full of comics. Nope. That is not what the place was primarily full of. With Gen Con, on the other hand, role-playing has not found the easy tie-in that comic books had.
What do you mean? Are you saying that the Dungeons & Dragons movie wasn't a massive success and it paved the way for
the third one coming up?
Paved the way for more Dungeons & Dragons movies.
Yeah, I just can't watch that trailer without getting goosebumps.
But the cartoon is at Walmart for like $5 for the whole series.
So
cartoon is awesome.
And I think that is complicated by something else within the role-playing industry, which is this decentralization. That you have really left the only two giants of the role-playing industry are Paizo and WotC, now with White Wolf kind of seeding the field.
Yeah, and Games Workshop, but they're in a different, you know. And you
do have some board games and whatnot there as well. I mean, you have Mayfair and whatnot that make a pretty good showing. But if you look at role-playing games themselves, they have become very decentralized. You have a lot of small press, what we would call medium press, but any other industry would say that's also small press. Games that are moving tens, hundreds, maybe a couple thousand copies, who are not going to be able to afford a booth at Gen Con. And therefore, Gen Con seems to be, every year I go, while the culture there, the game halls are packed, people are talking about role-playing games, wearing role-playing game t-shirts, but you walk through the exhibitors hall, you look at who's there, and it seems to be kind of less and less about role-playing games each year. And I say this as someone who's been to multiple Gen Cons, but has only been to one Comic-Con.
Right.
Jim, I want to re-pick your brain on what's your take on all of this. Do you agree with my observations? Disagree?
I agree. And I mean, one of the things that, and we didn't talk about this in San Diego, but it's something that actually we've touched on already in the lead up to this discussion, which I think is one of the central differences between Gen Con and San Diego. People go to Gen Con to do stuff. They don't go to Gen Con to stand in line. You know, you've just mentioned it. The gaming halls are packed. Yeah, you can have panels or individual things that are, you know, have decent showing at them. But you're not going to get 6,500 people to go and sit for 3 days and not play games. They go to Gen Con to do stuff. They go to Gen Con to interact, which in one way makes Gen Con a healthier gathering of people because they're people who are actually actively involved in their hobby. It takes more to learn how to play Magic and to actually play Magic sitting across from somebody else or to play especially a role-playing game that requires a lot of investment to play than it does to sit and passively let a TV show flow over you. I think that's a substantial difference between the two audiences. The people that go to Gen Con might go to Comic-Con, but they probably would find it less entertaining. And there is a subset of people who would go to San Diego, the people who are costuming, the people who are actually more actively involved in what they're doing, would find more to do at Gen Con. But the Gen Con audience is actually much more actively involved in what they're doing.
See, that's surprising for me to hear because I would have figured the exact opposite. I haven't been to Comic-Con. Of the coverage I've seen, there's a lot more exhibition booths, things like here is the Iron Man armors to see. Here are the new video games that are out. You have a chance to play. Versus when I went to Gen Con, the exhibitors hall was essentially just people trying to sell me stuff.
Right.
And it was all merchandise.
But what happens when you sell that stuff? And that's a really great example because you go up to that Iron Man armor and you look at it and you nod and you go, wow, cool. And then you go off and you wait in line for the Twilight panel.
No, I don't.
If you
No, you don't. But...
Well, hypothetically.
Comic-Con to me was the exhibitor hall is more like a museum because like just like what you said, you go in to experience the spectacle of it. You're going to walk around and observe it, maybe buy some stuff. But
people are announcing new products and different things like that.
Right.
They're not necessarily there for the people to sell stuff. There are people on the fringes, the artists, and then down on the other end where the people did have the long boxes of comics and the back shoes and the books and stuff. They were actually doing a pretty good business selling stuff. But when you go to that hall at Gen Con and you buy the latest board game or you buy the newest Magic expansion, what are you going to do with it?
Play it. Yeah.
You're going to walk out of that hallway and you're going to break it open. And you're going to go
to the multitude of game rooms to play it. And that was another big difference at Comic-Con. When you leave the exhibitors hall, there's nothing else. I mean, it's like you walk out of there and there's nothing else to the con. It's all in that main exhibitors hall.
Right. And there's
so whereas at Gen Con, there's all the game rooms and stuff. So yeah, that is a huge difference that I hadn't actually thought of until you brought that up. That's
no,
a very
I
point.
Hadn't either. The fact that he's right.
Yeah.
Comic-Con, while huge, and it has a spectacle that if you're listening to this and have the means to do so, I do recommend going to check out at least once.
It's a great show. I mean, I've done signings the last 2 years. I did a signing this year for Beyond the Wall that went really well. And it's a great place to go and interact with people that way.
Right.
And there is a game track, and some of the companies like Steve Jackson is actually doing more in setting some of the stuff up to do a game track. I think there was some Pathfinder stuff this year. There probably was some Magic stuff, but it's a lot harder to find that stuff, and it's not the focus of the show.
And even the stuff that you are, quote unquote, doing, it's relatively quick. I mean, you go up and you maybe catch an artist or an author, and if they're not a massive name where you're having to stand in an hour-long line, you might get to chat with them for a few minutes, get an autograph, something like that. There's an artist I knew well enough that we were able to go out and hang out for a couple hours and go to a lunch with them. Mm-hmm. They had stations set up where you could try out a few video games. They're still in beta. You could play the new Tomb Raider game, but it's not like you could take it with you. It's not like you took that back to your room and then had a LAN party with six other strangers or something like that, the way you do a Gen Con. And yeah, I'll agree with Pat that I really had not looked at it that way, that Comic-Con, as cool as it is, and we're very strongly thinking about going back to it next year, is very much a consumption event. as opposed to Gen Con, which is very much a participation event. You gotta look at Gen Con, the blockbuster event at Gen Con, at least for most people I chat with, even if they're not interested in it, what they'll identify as the blockbuster event that's impossible to get into and blah, 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 is True Dungeon.
Right.
It's not a panel. It's not getting your picture taken with somebody. It's not getting somebody's autograph. It's something that you have to go and actively do over the course of a couple hours.
Actually, the first job I almost got at TSR, I interviewed a couple of times before I got the job in the book division. I almost got the job of running Gen Con back in 87, which thank God I did not. I frequently look back at that and thank the fates for that.
Yeah, Peter Atkinson's a good guy. So,
but running Gen Con back in the late 80s and early 90s for TSR was just an incredibly thankless job. Mm. And initially when I started at TSR, I mean, we used to set up the booths. We used to do a lot of the programming focused stuff. We did a lot of that sort of thing at the company. We were all expected to be schlepping boxes and, you know, setting up the castle back in the day.
I remember the castle.
In Milwaukee. And one of the things that, you know, really strikes you when you go to Gen Con, and I've gone to every Gen Con since the last year it was at Parkside, first as a fan and then working at TSR and then working in the industry, is how much of a community event it is. And it is people going and getting together and doing stuff. You run into people playing werewolf in the hallways. You can go to any hotel lobby at 3 o'clock in the morning. There'll be somebody playing something. That's so different from science fiction conventions or conventions like San Diego. Now, the downside of all of this, the flip side of that is maybe because of what it requires for the buy-in to be part of that community, it's not a convention that people will attend casually. It's not something that you're going to get a lot of people coming to Indianapolis to bask in the reflected glory of Gen Con the way they do San Diego, where they want to go out and watch the people walking around in the costumes, or to see, oh, look, I caught a glimpse of Robert Downey Jr. slinking off to the MTV party over there, you know, that you will do in San Diego. So maybe that's part of the reason why the growth, you know, if it's going to continue, is not going to be exponential the way San Diego started growing when Hollywood took notice and started sending, you know, major movie stars and premier stuff down
there. Right. At least not until we get a decent movie.
Yeah, you get some major movie stars every year at Gen Con. You'll see the growth grow exponentially. Yeah.
Except I don't think we're in any danger of that, having seen the trailer for the most recent D&D movie. So anyway, Jim, I want to thank you very much for taking the time out to talk with us. Once again, for those of you at home, be sure to check the show notes. We will have links to Beyond the Wall. We will have links to Jim's website if you want to keep up with him.
And Jim, I want to let you know, I now have a new question for my list of things to interrogate WotC folks about, or TSR folks.
Okay.
I've got Red Steel. I still want to know who made those hamsters. And now I'm going to find out who nuked Chult. And I will make sure, Jim, that they never work in this industry again.
Oh, yes. That's right.
You nuked Dinosaur Island, and you are done.
That's right.
All right. As for you guys at home, thank you very much for tuning in. As always, have a great week and great game, and we will catch you guys next time. This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2012. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.